Good morning. Please turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 42. Last week, I walked you through the first part of the story of Joseph, and I hope as I'm walking you through these stories that obviously we can't read every verse, read every chapter, pay attention to every detail. I hope it's enticing you to open your Bibles at home and read these stories in detail. Last week, we talked about the first part of the Joseph story, which, for my money, is one of the absolute best stories in the entire Bible. It's my favorite story in Genesis, probably my favorite story in the Old Testament. I never get tired of returning to the story of Joseph. It's the story of Jacob, the patriarch. You got three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's the story of Jacob's 11th son, who was his favorite son. And it's the story of Joseph, this favored son, who ascends to power unexpectedly in Egypt after a series of trials and hardships set in motion when his 10 older brothers sell him into slavery because they are jealous of him. And last week we talked about how the Joseph story is a bit different than all the other stories in the book of Genesis because God is not front and center, it's more backstage, behind the scenes. There is a hiddenness to God's activity in the story of Joseph. And it's not really until you get to the middle or the end of the story that you begin to see, oh, so this is what God was doing through Joseph in Egypt and why all of these bad things happened to this young man. We saw last week how God uses every single negative experience Joseph has with his brothers and also while he's in Egypt to humble Joseph and to mature him into a young man and then a middle-aged man who is capable of saving the world. He uses these negative experiences to give Joseph the skills he needs to be the one who can save Egypt and the surrounding nations from a seven-year famine. And this is where we pick up the story today in Genesis chapter 42. The famine has begun, and the nations are now coming to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, who is overseeing this massive project where Egypt was the only one ready for the famine, stored their grain, and now they're able to sell it, distribute it to the nations, and thousands of lives are being saved. So in Genesis chapter 42, Jacob, the patriarch, the leader of his family, hears that there's grain for sale in Egypt. And so he sends his 10 sons to Egypt with some silver to buy some grain for the family. Now, he does not send his youngest son, Benjamin, who is Joseph's little brother. Both Joseph and Benjamin are sons of Jacob and Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel. And with Jacob thinking Joseph is dead, it appears now Benjamin is his new favorite son from his favorite wife. And Jacob is not about to let Benjamin go on this journey with his older brothers to Egypt. And so he holds him back. And so these 10 older brothers, they go to Egypt. And they appear before Joseph. But he's been transformed into this regal Egyptian official. And they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. And they bow down before him. And when they do, Joseph remembers those dreams he had when he was 17 years old. He had a couple of dreams where he dreamt that members of his family would bow down before him. And as his brothers are there in Egypt and they're bowing down before him, Joseph remembers those dreams and realizes the dreams of his youth are coming true. And this has to be a satisfying moment for Joseph. He's endured so much, put up with so much, suffered so much. He didn't give up. And now he's the one with all the power. And his brothers are there before him in need. How will he respond? Well, he doesn't reveal himself to them. not ready for a happy family reunion yet. Instead, what Joseph does is he speaks harshly to his brothers. He accuses them of being spies. And they say, no, we're not spies. We're just a bunch of brothers. We have one father. There were 12 of us. And then they tell their family story. There were 12 of us. One of them's back home with dad, and the other is no more. The other was sold into slavery by you. They're telling Joseph's story to Joseph, and they don't even realize it. And Joseph has all the power now. What's he going to do? Well, he throws them in prison for 3 days. Why? Maybe he doesn't know what to do with them. Maybe he just wants them to sweat. Maybe he's angry. But he throws them in prison for 3 days. And then after 3 days, he says, you can go home with your bags of grain so that your family doesn't starve. But the next time you come here for grain, I want you to bring that little brother with you to prove that you are honest men. You will not do business in Egypt again if you don't bring that little brother with you. And then he keeps one of them in prison. Simeon keeps one of his brothers in prison as collateral. And this is how his brothers respond to this harsh treatment from this Egyptian official. Chapter 42, verse 21, they said to one another, surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. This is a new detail to the story of what happened when they threw Joseph in the pit and then sold him into slavery. They actually sat down and had a meal. They throw him in a pit, and then they have a meal next to the pit, and they say now they could hear him crying out for mercy, asking them to save him, and they ignored his pleas. We would not listen, and now that's why this distress has come on us, they say. And then Reuben, the firstborn, who really, really, really wants to be the leader of the family, he tries, but he's just not cut out for it. He even tried to save Joseph initially when the brothers wanted to kill him. Reuben says, well, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy after all these years? I told you so, but you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. The guilt is thick in this room with his brothers, and Joseph is there hearing it. They didn't realize he could understand them because he was using an interpreter. But he turned away from them and he began to weep. But then he came back and spoke to them again. And he had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. And then he sends them home with sacks full of grain. But he tells his servants to put the silver they brought with them to buy the grain, put it back in their sacks. Now, why would he do this? We're not sure, but remember, they sold him into slavery for silver. And on the way home, one of them opens the sack of grain, and there's the silver. They don't see this as an act of compassion. They panic. They all open their bags of grain, and they all have their silver, and their hearts sink, and they tremble in fear, and they say to each other, what is this that God is doing to us? They assume that God is doing this to them, when in reality, it's Joseph pulling all the strings. Which raises a question. Why is he treating them this way? Why is he messing with them? He has all the power. They have none. He can do whatever he wants. Why does he accuse them of being spies, throw them into prison, tell them, you got to bring your little brother back here, keep one of them in prison until they do, put the silver in their sacks? What is he doing here? Is he just messing with them, playing games with them? Is this his way of getting his revenge? Is he teasing them? Has all this power gone to Joseph's head? Or is he testing them? I think he's testing them. I think he wants to know what kind of men his brothers have become after all these years. He has no reason to trust them, no reason to believe anything good about them, and every reason to believe the worst about them. How does he know what they've done to Benjamin over these years? It's his little brother from his father's favorite wife. How does he know? You say Benjamin's back home. How do I know you haven't gotten rid of him the way you got rid of me? He's testing them. He wants to know. And as he tests them, as he's feeling them out, he puts them in a situation where they obviously feel the full weight of their guilt for what they did to him. Notice how quick they are to assume all these bad things are happening. Why? Because of what we did to Joseph. They carry that guilt with them around into and out of, back and forth from Egypt. It's because of Joseph. Now, one of the details, if you read through this story carefully, one of the things you'll notice is that Joseph does a lot of weeping. He's a very weepy guy in this section of the story. And what is the first thing that makes him weep? The first time he weeps is when he overhears his brothers expressing their guilt for what they did to him. At the very least, they're guilty. We don't know if they're different yet, but they're guilty, and they feel it. And so they go home and tell Jacob, that paragon of virtue, everything that has happened. This harsh Egyptian official threw us into prison, wants to see Benjamin, kept Simeon in prison until we come back. And this is how Jacob responds to their story. Chapter 42, verse 36. Their father Jacob said to them, "You," says to his sons, "you have deprived me of my children." As if, okay, this is all your fault. Interesting thing is, it is all their fault. "You've deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Now Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me," says Jacob. Selfish much, Jacob? Is it really all about you? And then Reuben, that firstborn who just would love to be the leader, he says to his father, "You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust Benjamin to my care, and I will bring him back." Isn't that a great strategy? Hey, granddad, if I don't deliver, you can kill your grandkids. That's why Reuben will never be the leader of the family. That's his strategy. That's his solution to the problem. Notice, he doesn't say, "You can put me to death." He doesn't offer himself as a sacrifice. He offers his children as a sacrifice if he doesn't deliver. Well, Jacob isn't interested in this. He says, "My son, Benjamin, my son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow." You've ever wondered why Jacob's sons, Joseph's brothers, are so messed up? Here's some evidence. Here's an explanation. This is the kind of dad that raised them. He immediately assumes Simeon's no more. He just writes Simeon off because he's not about to put Benjamin at risk, send him to Egypt so that he could save his other son. No, forget about it. Simeon, Joseph, now have lost two sons. And imagine being those older brothers who listen to your father say, "Benjamin is the only one I have left. Yeah, he's the only son I have left from my favorite wife, but it says he's the only son I have left. He's the only one that really matters to me. And if I lose him, it will kill me." Gee, Dad, does this mean I'm not getting anything for Christmas? No wonder they're so messed up. Sometimes we carry stuff forward with us. We get in a lot of trouble because of bad choices and mistakes and sins that we commit, but sometimes it starts with the family in which we were raised and the wounds we pick up, the things our parents say and do and don't say and don't do, and we carry that forward and it shapes our life in a negative way. It's easy to make these brothers villains in the story. But they grew up constantly hearing, "You're not my favorite, you're not enough, and I don't love you as much as I love somebody else." Imagine what it must have been like to carry that burden around. Well, the famine is severe, only about 2 years into it, five more years to go, and Jacob leaves Simeon in prison. Doesn't send anybody there to get him out. We'll just leave him in Egypt. And then Jacob and his family eat all the grain. And when they eat their way through the grain they brought back with them, Jacob says, "Okay, boys," as if he's forgotten. And he's getting older, so maybe he did forget. But He says, okay, go back to Egypt and buy some more grain. As if nothing has happened. It should be an easy thing to do. Take the silver, try to use it this time, and get us some more grain. And Judah, who's emerging as the leader of the brothers, he's the fourth born, not the firstborn, but Reuben's never going to make it. So it's Judah who steps up, and he says, Dad, we can't go back there without Benjamin. Trust me, this guy was serious. He will not sell us any grain if we don't take Benjamin with us. And Jacob says, I'm not sending my boy. It seems Jacob is so attached to Benjamin, he's willing to let his family starve before he will let go of his beloved son. Well, if Jacob isn't going to lead the family, Judah steps up to do it. And he implores his father. He will not give up. He says, Dad, you have to understand this is a matter of life and death. We're all going to die if you don't send Benjamin. And then Judah steps up and does something Reuben wasn't able or couldn't do. Judah says, I will take responsibility. I guarantee his safety. And if I don't bring him back to you, the blame and the burden may fall squarely on me. And that's enough for Jacob. He relents, and he sends Benjamin with his brothers into Egypt. They get to Egypt, and they appear before Joseph. And Joseph sees his little brother Benjamin there, and he engineers another test. He takes them all over to his house for lunch, sets up this big spread, this big table, and he's still messing with them. He seats them according to their birth order, and they're all kind of like, how does he know how old we are and who the firstborn is and who the secondborn? And they're all sitting there, and there Benjamin is. And then when it's time to serve the food, he has Benjamin served five times the portion of all the other brothers. They all get just a plate of food, but Benjamin, it's all you can eat piled on his plate. What's that about? I think it's a test. He's observing his brothers. He wants to know, how are you going to respond when you see your little brother treated favorably? You still jealous? You're going to whisper among yourselves? It happens at home. It happens in Egypt. I hate that guy. See, he knows they're guilty. What he does not yet know is, have they changed? Are they different? Has their guilt transformed them in any way? Because you can feel guilty and still do the same thing over and over and over again, just compound the guilt. He doesn't know yet. Are you different? Have you changed? And so he engineers this test. And the test continues after the meal. He sends them all home with their bags full of grain. And he tells his steward, give them their silver back. And then he says, I want you to take my prized silver cup and I want you to put it in the sack of the youngest brother. And then he sends them home. And they must feel so relieved. They've got their grain. They've got Simeon. He's with them now. They're going to get Benjamin out of Egypt. They're going back home, and they're on the outskirts of town, and they look in their rearview mirror, and they can see the flashing lights. Oh, what is it? Because Joseph has sent his steward to chase them down, pull them over, and accuses them, says, one of you has stolen my master's prized silver cup. And the brothers are indignant. I mean, why would they steal anything from Egypt? They just want to get out of Egypt alive with their grain, with their brother. And they protest and say, no, we would never be that stupid. There's no way any of us stole that cup. If any one of us was dumb enough to steal the cup, you can put him to death, and the rest of us will be slaves in Egypt for the rest of our lives. Well, the steward says, you don't have to go that far. No reason for anybody to die. How about this? If one of you stole the cup, that brother comes back. He's a slave in Egypt, and the rest of you can go on free. You're innocent of the crime. Just let the one who's guilty be punished. And then he starts opening the sacks of grain. And in my mind, he starts with the oldest. There's got to be some drama here. And he opens. No, the silver's there, but not the cup. And he's working his way down. And they're relieved, but also they don't like the odds. And then they finally get to Benjamin's sack, the youngest brother, and open. And there's the silver cup, and their worst nightmare comes true. Of all the terrible things that could have happened, not this. We can't leave him in Egypt. The steward says they're free to go. He's the guilty one. You come with me. You guys can go home. And instead, all of the brothers choose to go back into the city and face Joseph together. That is a positive sign. And then they get in front of Joseph, and Joseph reiterates, you don't all have to be here. It's just this one who's guilty. He's a slave now. You can go home. And this is the culmination of Joseph's test. So what does he really want to know? He wants to know, will you, my older brothers who sold me into slavery to get rid of me, will you use this opportunity? It's so convenient. Will you use this opportunity to leave your little brother, your father's favorite son, behind in Egypt? You have an excuse to get rid of him the same way you got rid of me. You can go home and you can blame it on him and say he was a criminal, he deserves it, and you get rid of this little brother you're so jealous of. And this is the moment of truth for the brothers. Have they changed? We know Joseph has learned a lot from his time in Egypt. Have they learned anything as they've carried their guilt around now all these years? And it's Judah who steps up on behalf of the brothers. And this is part of what he says to Joseph. So now, if the boy, referring to Benjamin, is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, my father will die. It will kill him. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, Judah says, please, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy. And let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come on my father. That's a long way from throwing your little brother in a pit, having a meal as he cries out and says, would you please save me? Please get me out of here. That's a long way from selling your little brother into slavery and then taking his coat, dipping it in blood, and deceiving your brother, your father, breaking your father's heart so that he believes his favorite son is dead. That's a long way from what they did to Joseph. Judah says, take me instead. I can't do that to my father. Not again. And Judah's speech breaks Joseph's heart wide open. He reveals himself to his brothers. He can't contain himself any longer. It's more weeping. And then he says, chapter 45, verse 12, you can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it really is I who am speaking to you. Tell my father all about the honor according to me in Egypt and about everything you've seen, and bring my father down here quickly. And then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him, weeping, and he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And afterwards, his brothers talked with him. What do you think they had to talk about? And then Pharaoh hears about this joyous family reunion. And he tells Joseph, tell your father to bring all of his people, the whole clan, move them from Canaan into Egypt so that they will be protected from this famine. We have 5 more years of it. And this is a key event in the story of Israel, because this explains how the children of Israel ended up in Egypt, living and thriving and multiplying. So much so that centuries later, a Pharaoh arises who knew not the story of Joseph, hadn't heard about this Israelite who had saved Egypt from a famine. All he saw were these multiplying Israelites in his land, and he's threatened, and so he enslaves them, which sets the stage for the Exodus story where God will save his people from slavery. This is how it happens. This is the A to the B, which leads to the C. But the Joseph story isn't just setting the stage for the Exodus. There's this big, grand story that it's a part of, but there's also this smaller story, this family drama. And the Joseph story is pulling together several strands of drama that have been running throughout Genesis. These open questions, these problems that need to be solved. One such thread of drama is the tension fathers feel when they're put in a situation where they have to let go of their beloved son. God tests Abraham and asks him to sacrifice Isaac. Abraham passes the test because he's willing. He doesn't have to, but he's willing to let go of his son. And Jacob is put in the same situation. He's got to be willing to let go. Will he sacrifice Benjamin? Is he willing to lose a son for the sake of his entire family? Can he let go? Another thread of drama is this ongoing sibling rivalry. See it all the way through Genesis. It happens very early in Genesis chapter 4. Cain and Abel, and then Isaac and Ishmael, and then Jacob and Esau, and then Rachel and Leah. And then Jacob's sons, Joseph's brothers. And there's this pattern of conflict that emerges because one brother typically is more blessed than the other brother or brothers, and they're jealous. And the consequences can be deadly because they don't manage their jealousy. They don't manage the spirit and the sense of competition with one another in a positive, healthy way. And so Cain kills Abel. Esau will kill Jacob if he doesn't flee. He's dead. Esau's a mighty hunter, but he flees. And Joseph's brothers almost kill him. As you read through Genesis, you wonder, what's it going to take to get this family together? What's it going to take to get these brothers to stop competing with each other and working together? And then the third thread that runs throughout Genesis is, it seems God is always searching for a human partner who can embody his desire to bless the nations. That's God's intent. I'm going to bless Abraham so that I can bless his family, so that I can bless all the nations. And God makes these huge promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm going to bless you, your family, but I'm doing it so that I can bless all the nations. God isn't interested in cursing the world. He wants to bless the world. And yet, all the patriarchs have this selfish propensity to grab the blessing for themselves at the expense of other people. I want this blessing so badly, it's mine. And if I have to lie, deceive someone, hurt someone to get it and to keep it, I will. And God is looking for, in Genesis, he's looking for a human being who can receive his blessing with open hands and then distribute it to others, because there's always enough of God's blessing to go around. There's always enough blessing for everyone if we receive it with an open hand. And so, as the Joseph story comes to its resolution, we see all three of these threads come together. They're interwoven. Jacob does it. He's challenged to let go of his beloved son for the good of his family. He does it, and he's rewarded. Not only does he save his family from famine, but he also gets his dead son back. A father was willing to sacrifice his beloved son, and he gets his son back from the dead. Does that sound familiar? He does it. He lets go. And Judah, let's not move too quickly over what Judah did. He lets go of his jealousy. Let's go of the bitterness and the resentment he feels toward his father, but also toward his little brothers, the favorites. And he steps up And he's the first person in Genesis to offer himself as a sacrifice in place of someone else. Because he cannot bear to break his father's heart again, he sacrifices himself, and the spiraling conflict between rival brothers is broken finally when somebody steps up and puts his life on the line for the sake of someone else. And then there's Joseph. He's got all the power. He's got the opportunity. Surely he has the desire to exact revenge on his brothers, and he's able to let go. Let go of the anger, let go of the pain, let go of the suffering, and forgive them, so not only can they be saved, but he can still save the nations of the earth. And God can keep his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it all comes together. Their broken lives, their fractured family, God's larger story, it all moves forward because they're all able to let go. Now, I had originally intended to say, now, if the major players in this story hadn't been able to let go, if Jacob doesn't do his thing and Judah doesn't do his thing and Joseph doesn't do his thing, then God's story comes to a screeching halt because God needs us to always do the right thing in order to move the story forward. But you know that's not true. That's not the way it works in Genesis. God is able to move his story forward even when his human partners aren't fully on board and aren't doing the right thing. So God is eminently, infinitely creative and capable of moving things forward even if we're not cooperating. But when we don't cooperate, we don't move forward with God. God is able to take the evil we do to each other and use it for good. I love what Joseph says to his brothers in chapter 45 when he reveals himself. He says, "Now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." There's a famine, 2 years, five more. "But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and save your lives by a great deliverance." Joseph actually says, "You didn't do this to me, God did." Now, they did it to him, but he's now able to say, "But I don't hold it against you because of the way God is using it for the good of so many." That's very hard to say in the moment. It's a lot easier to say in hindsight when you begin to see how things are unfolding. And he has to say it again later on in chapter 50 because his brothers cannot let go of their guilt. They're still carrying it with them, and they're afraid he's going to retaliate after Jacob dies. And so in chapter 50, verse 19, it's the most famous line from the Joseph story. He says to his brothers, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done. You intended evil, but God made it good. The saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. It's hard to let go. I don't want to pretend it's not this morning. Letting go can be one of the hardest things we have to do in our lives as we're moving forward with God. But when we can believe that somehow God is at work in our lives behind the scenes, backstage, turning the evil done to us into some kind of good, when we can believe that our sacrifices and our pain and our suffering, God somehow using that for someone else's benefit, when we can believe that even though life has seemed unfair to us and we've been treated unjustly, God is still with us and God is for us and God loves us and he's never going to abandon us, when we can begin to see God at work in the big picture, it makes it a little bit easier to let go of the things we hold on to that keep us stuck. Which brings me to this question. I had somebody in first service say, "You know, it was a great sermon until you asked that last question." What is God inviting you to let go of this morning? How is God using the Joseph story to call you and invite you to open up and let go of something you're holding on to that is holding you back, that has got you stuck, that is keeping you from being able to move forward in a meaningful way in your life? What's the time to let go of? Is it time to let go of your obsession with competition? Because that's your way of demonstrating you're better than other people and proving that you're worthy of a blessing from God. God loves you for who you are, not what you do, not how you compare to other people. Is it time to let go of your jealousy? It has a stranglehold on your heart because it seems God is blessing someone else in your family, on your street, in your church more than God is blessing you. Is it time to let go of that anger and the resentment you feel because after all these years, your marriage, your family, your career, it's not turning out the way you thought it would? And you're angry. Either angry at other people for the way they've treated you, or you're angry at God. Is it time to let go? Is it time to let go of your desire to take revenge on those who have hurt you? You want to see them suffer like you've suffered. You want to hurt them the way they have hurt you. And I do not want for a minute to minimize the evil that some of you have experienced at the hands of others. And your heart is filled with rage. And you want to punish them. You don't want a reconciliation. And many times reconciliation isn't good. It's not possible. It's not wise. Sometimes it's best just to leave it alone. But still, you carry this vengeance in your heart. And it's poisoning your soul. It's having no effect on the person who hurt you, but it's destroying you. Is it time to let go? Is it time to let go of that guilt you've carried around for years because of that thing or series of things or the way you lived long ago? You can't set it down. You gave your life to Christ. You've been baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, and yet you still feel guilty. You still look down in shame. You still wonder if you're worthy to take the bread and the cup when the plates are passed. Is it time to let go of your guilt? God has. You are forgiven in Christ. 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 How many times will you have to hear it before you can let go of the guilt and shame? Is it time to let go of your fear of being wrong, your fear of making a mistake, your fear of looking foolish, being rejected, being told no, disappointing someone important to you? Or is it just time to let go of your need to pretend that you have nothing to let go of? Because to admit you need to let go of something would be to admit weakness, and you do not do that. God doesn't need us to let go to keep moving his story forward. God can always find a way. But we have to let go to move forward with God. And so may we hear the Spirit moving in this story this morning, stirring our hearts. And may God show each of us what it is we need to let go of. And may God give us the courage to take the first step toward letting go. And if you don't know what that means, know what that looks like, you're not sure how to let go, please don't leave this place or don't let this day end without talking to someone you trust who can help you discern what your next step is toward letting go. So we all have something to let go of, but letting go is going to look differently for each of us. May we all let go. May we let go of what is holding us back so that we can move forward together with God, in step with the Spirit, and in step with this large story God is pushing forward. May we move forward with God as we stand and sing.